The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And good morning and welcome to this September 4th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook. Also, Writers on Writing. We are doing a little survey for our listeners. If you are a longtime listener or a, you know, just a new listener, we'd love to hear from you. And if you write in at penonfire@earthlink.net, let us know how we're doing. Let us know if there's something else you'd like to listen to, if there are other authors, format. Anyway, just feel free to give us a shout and let us know what you think, good or bad. I am your host, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. I'm here now with Christy Lefteri, and coming up in the second half, Susan Strait will be here talking about her memoir, In the Country of Women. Christy Lefteri is the, she was brought up in London. She is the child of Cypriot refugees. She's a lecturer in creative writing at Brunel University and the author of the novel A Watermelon, A Fish, and A Bible. Her latest novel, The Beekeeper of Aleppo, was born out of her time working as a volunteer at a UNICEF-supported refugee center in Athens. It's published by Ballantine Books, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Christy, welcome.
Hi there.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on. So The Beekeeper of Aleppo was born out of the experience at UNICEF, as opposed to you wanting to write a novel and working at UNICEF as a way of researching the material. I'd just love for you to talk a little bit about that experience, kind of what led you to UNICEF and kind of how the novel was born out of that.
Right. Well, it was the spring of 2016, and I went to visit my dad in Cyprus. He lives on the far east side of Cyprus. My parents were refugees as well, so they moved to London after the war in Cyprus in 1974. So I sort of grew up under the shadow of those traumas that my parents went through. My dad was a commanding officer of that war. So I remember that spring I went to visit him, and I was sitting on this really beautiful shore looking out across the water and thinking, Syria is not that far away and there's this awful war going on. And I just couldn't get that thought out of my head. So when I went back to London, I thought to myself, you know, I've got this long summer because I work as a lecturer in creative writing. What can I do? So I decided to go to Athens to work in there. It was a mother and women and children's center. So basically, the refugees that were staying in the camps in Athens, so there were a few camps, like at the old school and at the old airport, they'd come to the Women and Children's Center, and it was a place of safety for them.
Hmm. So you, you know, it feels to me like this refugee story must just be like living inside of you, you know, that, sort of at the DNA level. I mean, that you had to have experienced this sort of intergenerational trauma of your parents being refugees. And
yeah.
Given your two novels, you know, the refugee story just feels like one that you might need to tell again and again in its many iterations. Is that kind of how it has felt for you even since childhood, that this refugee story is one that you need to tell and one that sort of just inhabits you?
Oh, God, absolutely, definitely. I mean, my first novel, Watermelon, A Fish and a Bible, was actually, it was about the war in Cyprus in 1974. It wasn't my parents' story. It's set during the first 8 days of that invasion. So you can see that the whole thing is really in my heart and it's really part of who I am. And I think when I went to Athens, you know, something absolutely compelled me to go, but I didn't realize at the time. I just, you know, when you just get this feeling, you think, I have to do this. I have to go and do this thing, you know. And but after, when I looked back, I thought I was so compelled to go and help. And I wondered if it was because I'd seen what my parents had been through. They didn't really talk about the war, but it was always there. Mm. You know, it was there in their reactions sometimes. It was there in the community because there was a huge Cypriot community in London, people that had been displaced after the war. So I think when I was there in the, at the centre and seeing people coming fresh, you know, from the war into, you know, they'd normally passed through Turkey and then got to an island and eventually got to Athens, and they were still traumatised, the children were traumatised. And we had like a play area for children, and we had an area where, so if new mothers had just given birth, there was an area where they could sit down and we could help them tend to the baby, and there were warm showers for them so they wouldn't have to have showers at the camp where they were hosed down. And just being there, it was really chaotic. You know, I was often just whizzing around and didn't have time to think. But when I'd go home at night, all the things that I'd seen and the stories that I heard, they would just all go round and round and round in my head. And I think that's what kind of, it made me start writing. I really wanted to use that sadness that I was feeling when I was there and experiencing everything. And it kind of got me writing, and then eventually the story developed.
It's so interesting reading this from the American perspective, where, you know, if this book had come out 4 or 5 years ago and we were reading about Syria, it would have felt very distant and, you know, something happening to another group of people. And as we are sitting here in the States, I'm sure, as you know, we're going through our own refugee crisis and these camps. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, there's such a feeling of relevance and immediacy and viscerality that I think that, you know, it's just the right novel at just the right time for a lot of different countries, and, you know, not just a distant thing. The other thing that I think is interesting is how much our parents perhaps try to protect us from things that they have been through, and their silence is of some form of protection, and it never works that way. You know, I mean, their silence is almost even more harmful, because the child senses something's going on, but can't give language to it, or doesn't really understand what's going on.
God, it's so interesting that you say that, because I recently wrote an article for The Observer in London about transgenerational trauma. And while I was writing that article, I needed a break from it. I went for a walk, and my dad happened to call me. And he said to me, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just writing an article." And I explained to him what it was. And as soon as I explained it, I don't know what happened. He said to me, and this is the first time he's ever said it, he turned around and he said, "You know, I didn't talk about the war because I was trying to protect you." And the thing, and it's exactly what you just said now. And the thing is, I did say to him, I did feel it, though. I didn't want him to feel bad, but I said to him, I did feel it. He just started going into all these memories that he'd never spoken about and stuff that he'd experienced. And I thought, God, how interesting that I've written this novel, I was writing this article, and somehow that's made that made me and my dad have this conversation that we'd never had. And all the stuff he was telling me, the memories that he described, I did feel them. I had this fear of bombs when I was little. I kept thinking that bomb was going to fall, and I couldn't understand where that was coming from. I'd just jump out of bed in the middle of in the night and look through the window and then realize there was nothing there. Mm-hmm. And now, looking back, I wonder if I was sort of carrying something, if I'd kind of picked up on something that my parents weren't talking about.
Well, and obviously, because it feels like it's so seeped into you in your art and in your writing. So at its most superficial, the novel is about a Syrian refugee and his blind wife making their way out of Syria and through Turkey and Greece and ultimately to England. It's kind of about that journey, but more fundamentally, I mean it's really about post-traumatic stress, and it's about the nature of sight and vision and what it means to really see something, and it's about kindnesses and assaults and human nature at its best and worst. How am I doing it describing it? I should let you introduce
it. Brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I'm going to let you kind of take us into this world a little bit and tell us about these people.
Yeah, so I worked as a psychotherapist for a while. I did a psychoanalytic training for many years. I decided in the end not to complete the training because I wanted to use what I'd learned in my writing rather than to be a clinician. It was a huge decision that I made, but I'd learned so much from working as a psychotherapist and working with people that had suffered from various traumas and how those traumas manifested themselves, you know, because sometimes they'll manifest themselves physically rather than emotionally. So I think when I was, when, you know, the journey that Afra and Nouri go on, the physical journey is, like you say, it's like the lilies on a pond in a way. Mm. And the thing that's under the water, the core of the story, the heart of the story, is how their individual traumas, in a way, stop them from being able to love each other in the way that they want to. Mm. So the real journey is the journey that they make, or they try to make, back to each other again.
That's beautiful.
Through their trauma. So they have to try and work through those awful traumas, because they've just lost their child. I mean, they've lost everything.
Right.
And, you know, to imagine being in a situation like that, I mean, each of us would respond in a different way, in our own way. And I don't want to say too much about Nouri's response and Afra's response, because I'm afraid that I might, you know, give too much away. But they're both suffering, and Nouri's quite an unreliable narrator because of his suffering.
Right. So talk a little bit about excavating Nouri and Afra as well. But, you know, so you are working at UNICEF, and you're hearing just all of these stories. You're seeing all of this suffering. You're kind of taking in, I would imagine, you know, kind of like maybe a willing sponge, all of these people's stories. And,
yeah.
And from that emerges Nouri and Afra. And talk a little bit about how they presented themselves to you, and how you worked with them, and maybe some of the struggles of bringing them to life.
Yeah, so I remember when Nouri and Afra first came to my mind. It was 2016, because I went back in 2017 back to the centre. 2016, I like you said, I was hearing stories and I was seeing a lot of things. I wasn't really talking to people while I was at the centre. I was talking to people after, on Victoria Square. And that's where I was hearing the stories. While I was at the centre, I was seeing a lot of things. Like, for example, there was this mother that came in, and this actually comes up in the story. This new mother, her baby was absolutely tiny, and she was so traumatised that she couldn't breastfeed. And we were trying to give the baby formula, but he wasn't really taking the formula. He'd take a little bit. And anyway, all we could do was sit with her and you know, talk to her and give her milk and biscuits, because we didn't have a food license. And eventually she started to produce milk, and the baby started to feed, and, you know, his little eyes opened. And it was just a really sad but also amazing thing to see. So I remember during this time I started to get this sense, you know, I'd look around and I'd think, look at all these children that are here, the ones that have made it here. You know, like this little baby that's made it here with its mother and the other children that are playing. And I began to think about the children that hadn't made it there. And that was a horrible, horrible thought. And I couldn't digest that thought, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I remember getting an image in my mind, and it was a man and a woman. The woman was sitting on a bed, and it was the bed that her son used to sleep on. And the man came in from the streets, and everything was crumbling and the war was everywhere. And he came in holding a pomegranate in his hand, which he'd found rotting amongst some rotting fruit. But this was a single pomegranate that wasn't rotting. And he gave it to her as a gift, because he knew she loved pomegranates. And that was the scene that I had in my mind. I didn't know where it was going. I didn't know who these characters were. I could see that she was blind. So it was very clear in my head. And so I continued to work at the centre. I had this image in my mind of these characters and this kind of this missing child, the child that they'd lost, and which I think was so kind of influenced by the things that I'd seen and felt. But when I got back to London, these characters then started to come to life. But I needed to get back to London and have that kind of breathing space. And then it's as if they started to move mm-hmm. and talk. And become characters. But while I was in Athens, I remember it was more like a picture in my head rather than something that had come to life. I needed to come back to London before it started to blossom into Nouri and Afra and Sami.
It's so interesting that you say that, because we have that conversation on the show all the time about how you need physical distance from a place in order to see things
yeah.
a little bit more clearly. And when you're enmeshed in it, it's really difficult. I think, for the writer to get sort of the psychological distance to see what's really happening.
Exactly, yeah.
The nice thing, I suppose, as a writer, for this to be such a contemporary story is that perhaps, I don't know if you feel this way, you're able a bit to rely on the nightly news in order to give readers sort of, it, like, you don't have to be as didactic or as explainy as you would have to be perhaps in your first novel, where we're probably less familiar with, you know, 1974 and the Cyprus War as we are when we turn on the nightly news and see what's happening in Syria every day. And I don't know if that, you know, kind of you're thinking about how much you could rely on this, you know, being more familiar to readers' territory that you didn't have to explain as much, or...
No, do you know what? I think I would have written it in exactly the same way, whether I knew, whether it had been on the news or not. So even if I was writing a novel that hadn't, about something that hadn't been on the news, I don't think I would have explained more. Because I think I wanted the character's emotions to do the explaining. I didn't want it to be about the war itself or about, you know, because in a way you can take, in some small way, you can take Syria out of it, and it could be any migrant, any refugee from any place.
Right. True. Right, right.
That was my feeling. You know, I think that's what I was feeling when I was writing it. Not that the Syria part isn't important. Of course it is, because those were the people that I was working with, and it was those people that inspired me, both with the sadness and with the elements of hope. But again, there's so many people fleeing from so many different parts of the world now and before, and they'll be again in the future. So I think my novel is about those people that will have to leave their home, whether they have, whether they will, you know, maybe one day it will be us. I mean, who knows? You know, we never know which direction life will take us sometimes. And so I think that's what it was for me. It was about depicting the really raw emotions of these people that had to leave everything behind.
Yeah, yeah. One of my favorite things, and I have never seen this technique done before, is that, so the structure of the novel is, it's not complicated, but it does move back and forth in time from backstory to real time story. And the bridges between backstory and current story are done through either a word or a phrase. I was thinking of that little childhood thing of the Miss Lucy had a tugboat, and it would lead up to a word, and then that word would bridge into another idea in the little poem, right? So as I was reading it, I was like, this sounds like Miss Lucy. But so you would take a word that would be a bridge, is the only word I can think of to describe, from past
to... It is to, a bridge,
to present.
Yeah, that's a good way of describing it.
How did that come about? It's so cool. It's so cool.
Because I tell you what it was. So about 10 years ago, my mum died. And I remember that I'd be talking to somebody. I think I was present when they were talking to me. Well, I assumed I was. I thought I was. But they might have said something like, I don't know, blah, 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 do you want a cup of tea? And that word tea would just literally throw me into a memory and I'd be gone. I wouldn't be there with them anymore. They might have not realized that I wasn't there anymore. I was somewhere else. I could even respond. I remember now, looking back, I thought, you know, a word would trigger something and I'd be off in my head. You know, I'd be drinking tea with my mum somewhere, and then a whole memory would emerge, and I'd try and bring myself back to where I was in the present moment. I just couldn't. And so with Nuri, so it's in the present, and there's a word like bronze, for example, when he sees the bronze watch. And that word takes him back to Aleppo, back to the way that he sees the city, because he saw it. He saw it as if it looked like bronze, you know. So it's the watch, the bronze watch that the Moroccan man is holding, throws him into a memory of Aleppo. And so I guess it was my own experience of grieving that made me experiment in that way. And then when I tried it, I thought, well, this works. It's still quite real to me. So I used it as a device.
It's so great. And I've never seen it done before. I don't know if there are other, right? I mean, there's so much writing I haven't seen, but it's very clever. And it works as well because you shift between present and past tense. And so the reader, you know, kind of never gets lost in it and just picks up, and we're like, okay, now we're in a memory, and now we're in backstory, and now we're back in present tense. And I just thought that was really so effective.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about structure and organization and kind of what your office looks like as you're trying to put this novel together, because you have...
I don't know why that made me laugh, what my office looks like.
But you've got...
you've a mess.
I understand. You've got Mustafa, who is Nuri's cousin, and he is sending emails. So you've kind of got his little arc over here. So you kind of have these emails going on. You have Nuri, who we won't discuss, but, you know, kind of is a bit of an unreliable narrator because of the trauma he's been through. I mean, it's a lot of threads to keep in the air. And as we've mentioned, you know, it's going back and forth in time and, you know, events that they experienced, and now they're on the road and on the journey. It's kind of a lot, I would think, to keep in your writerly head. And I'm just trying to figure out how you organized the material from a writing perspective.
Okay, so what I tend to do when I'm doing my research, that's when I make my notes. So my research will be kind of memories about things that I saw and heard at the center, or it might be that I'm reading about the history of Syria, or I might be reading articles about things that people have said about migrants or about refugees, and I'll be making lots of different notes. So I've got like a notepad with all my notes from my research. When it comes to planning and writing the novel, I have no notes, nothing. I hold it in my head, and I think if something gets lost, then it has to be lost. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of weird. It's hard for me to explain it, but it's almost like it has like a musical rhythm somehow in my head, and I hear the rhythm, and then I have to sort of follow it through. So there's all those little threads are like a little bit of a different harmony, and I have to hold on to them in my mind. But I don't make notes. I feel like if I make notes, then I'm not allowing it to develop.
Right.
It's just, for some reason, it's just how it works with me. I've seen people do it in so many different ways, and I've discussed this with so many of my writer friends, and we've all got our own kind of own crazy way of doing it. And but I guess with me, I can't ground it on paper, in notes and in kind of plans and things. I've got to let it live and breathe in my head.
Right. Interesting. Were there scenes or things that you saw or heard when you were working at UNICEF that you wanted to get into the book, but, you know, based on narrative arc or whatever else, couldn't get in there, and they were scenes that you wrote that then had to be cut out?
There were loads because there were so many stories that I heard. You know, there were too many. Even now saying it, sometimes you can hear so many things that they start to blend together as well, you know?
Yeah.
But there were people that I met and I thought, you know, that had told me about, for example, I met a lot of refugees from Afghanistan as well, and they had told me about their journeys from Afghanistan, and I so wanted to include some of those, but it was just too much. I mean, I did with the character of Nadine, so that's where I thought, well, I can do that a little bit because I've got the character of Nadine here, and you know, he's a very troubled character in a way. He's somehow become lost completely in the darkness of all this, and he takes a wrong turn. And but you know, the story that he tells in the book, I met this really lovely man in Athens who was telling me about how he was playing the guitar, and that he wasn't allowed to play the guitar, and he needed to move because he wanted to go somewhere where he could play his music. And I remember saying to him, wow, you know, that's so sad. And we had this conversation, I said to him, I'm guessing that's not the only reason he left. And he said to me, no, it wasn't. But I felt like he didn't want to say more. But the bit of the story about the music, I kind of brought that into Nadine's character. But there were so many other stories that I heard about people leaving Afghanistan. I couldn't include them because it would have taken away from the story and the thread of the story. So that was one thing that, you know, there's always things that I have to say, well, no, I can't, that's not going to work. I have to leave that out.
Right. Is there any thought in your mind about doing any sort of nonfiction book about this? Well, you write articles about it.
Yeah, I write articles about it. So I wrote one about transgenerational trauma. I wrote another one about the power of storytelling. And also, I'm gathering stories. If anyone wants to have a look at my website, beekeeperofaleppo.com, there's stories that I've collected and edited with the manager at the Open Cultural Center in Thessaloniki, which is a camp in Thessaloniki. And the children there have written their own stories about their experience. So we've put already three of these stories up on the website.
Oh, that's great.
So I've
that's
been involved in those kind of things. But in terms of interviewing people and writing, I don't know, accounts, I wouldn't want to do that. I wrote the novel and now I want to kind of be involved with helping people to express themselves and finding ways to express themselves, which is what I've been trying to do.
Right. Did you have any refugee readers for this novel? Did you pass it by people who have been through some sort of experience?
I did. So when I came back to London after being in Greece 2016, I said that I had that image in my mind of this husband and wife. When I came back, I realized I wanted to write the novel. I found an Arabic tutor. And just by chance, I didn't know this, I found him on a website. And just by chance, he happened to be a refugee from Aleppo.
Wow.
And so I would see him once a week for an hour and a half. And I told him what I was doing. I said, look, I really want to write this story. I told him about my parents' experiences as refugees. I said to him, I can't stop thinking about it. I need to write something. And so what we did is we did 45 minutes of Arabic once a week and 45 minutes of going through the manuscript once a week.
Wow.
So I had that from Ibrahim for a whole entire year. Mm. So, for example, I couldn't go to Syria. I couldn't go. It was too dangerous. So when it got, there's a bit at the beginning where I'm writing about their escape from Syria. Ibrahim and I would sit down and look at maps together, and he would say to me, where do you want your characters to get to? And I'd say, from here to here. So we would go through the map of Syria, roads that he knew, and he'd tell me, right, so they'd go this way, that way, that way, that way, that way. Maybe they could take this turn. And as we were doing that, I'd say to him, what trees would be there? What would the sky look like at this time of day? You know, because every sky, in a way, in my mind, has a slightly different color. I remember when I went to New York and I looked up and I thought, wow, you know, the sky's massive here. You know, just little things that would kind of help me to bring the story to life. Or what does the soil smell like? What flowers might be here or what flowers might be there? Or, you know, so then we went into the bit where I had to write about Syria before the war. And that was really difficult because he was the one that was describing to me Syria before the war. And then he would invite me to go to these Syrian breakfasts that were taking place about once a month in Acton in London. And so I'd get to try all this lovely, beautiful food that was made and talk to loads of people and chat to people that were refugees and chat to other artists. Like, I met painters that were painting about the war and painting about their feelings of displacement. So Ibrahim opened up a world for me.
Incredible.
And without him, the novel wouldn't have been what it was. It just wouldn't, you know, he helped me to ground it in a reality that I couldn't have known without him.
Right. That's incredible. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Ugh, we're out of time. It kills me. But we can find you. Your website is beautiful. So the Beekeeper of Aleppo is the website. You have your own website as well.
BeekeeperofAleppo.com. I have that website for the time being.
Ah, okay. Okay. Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Are there other places where we can find you in addition?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah.
What's your handle?
I think it's Christy_Lefteri.
Excellent. Excellent. Christy Lefteri, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me to speak.
We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Susan Strait will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. If you've missed any part of this interview, you can find the full episode podcast in a couple of days or so. We are on iTunes under Writers on Writing. And as I mentioned in the first half, we're doing a little survey that we invite you to participate in. If you are a longtime listener or a new listener, give us a shout at penonfire@earthlink.net. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know if there are authors you want to hear, changes in format, whatever. This is your chance to write in and let us know how we are doing. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I am here now with Susan Strait. Susan has published 8 novels, including High Wire Moon and A Million Nightingales. She's been a finalist for the National Book Award and received the Robert Kirsch Award for Lifetime Achievement from the LA Times Book Prizes, the Henry Prize, the Lannan Literary Award for Fiction, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. Susan's essays have been published in The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, The New York Times, Granta, The Believer. In the Country of Women is her latest memoir. It's not your typical memoir. What's that saying? It's not your grandmother's memoir, except this kind of is your grandmother's memoir. It's multi-generational. It's about immigrants and slaves and Native Americans and mothers and daughters. It's about those who leave and those who stay. It's about a California a lot of us don't talk about or have never been to, no matter how close to it we live. It's about our country and what we're all going through. It's about the women who keep us together. Susan, welcome.
Thank you. It's so nice to hear your voice.
How am I
now
doing?
You made the book sound 12,000 words. 12,000 pages. It sounds very big now.
Love it. It is big. It is big. I'm sure you can do better about describing it, but I gave it my best shot.
No, you did a wonderful job. I just kept thinking as you were talking, like, dang, it does have all that stuff in there.
Yes, and more, and so much more. So your old professor, James Baldwin, told you back in graduate school that this was the story you needed to write. And I was just wondering if, you know, for all of these years later when you wrote it, were you waiting for the right time, or were you resisting it altogether? Was this always a memoir you intended to write?
Oh, wow. Just hearing you say that makes me miss him. I was very sad when he died, I remember, because he was so kind and generous to me and to my husband, and he was actually a friend. I mean, he came over to our house to eat dinner, and that's what I end up writing about in the book. And he was always extremely helpful with my fiction. He taught me about secondary characters, which is another big part of the book. It's that, you know, often as writers we're focused on our main characters, and we don't think about all of the heavy lifting that's done by the secondary characters in a story. And he's the first person that really had me think about fiction that way, my own fiction as well as the fiction I was reading. But that night that he came over, he saw this little piece of paper I had taped on the window in the kitchen. We had like a studio apartment, married student housing. I was 22, and he said, "Who wrote this? This is the most profound thing I've ever read." And it was George Clinton. It was "With the Rhythm It Takes to Dance" to "What We Have to Live Through, You Can Dance Underwater and Not Get Wet." Mm. And I told him it was George Clinton. And then Dwayne, my husband, he said, "I'll play you the song." And he turned on the boombox, and we played Aqua Boogie. And we sort of told James Baldwin, like, how we lived. And he said, "But you must write about this." And he didn't say I should not write fiction, but he said, "You must write about this, too. This is imperative." And I remember that word, imperative. It's such a lovely word. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't until really all the elders in my life started dying, as well as the younger people in our lives were also dying from violence, that I thought, I have to write this now. It's a different book than if I had written it 8 years ago when I first sat down to write it.
Mm-hmm. And a different book, not because of the elders passing, but because of where the country is right now. I mean, you do think that the racial and ethnic temperature in this country has been raised so high that what might have felt historical and maybe not irrelevant but not as visceral is once again so fraught. And were you writing this in the, I mean, this must have taken you much longer than the last 2 or 3 years to write, and I wonder how much it has changed in light of what has been going on with us in the last couple of years.
It's not just the things that you brought up, but mostly writing it as a woman right now was very different from how I would have written it 10 years ago. I've always been writing about our family's ancestors, whether they, you know, survived enslavement in Tennessee and Mississippi, that was my now ex-husband's grandmother's, or my own grandmother, my step-grandmother, who came as an immigrant and worked at Kaiser Steel as a nurse and used to tell me stories about, you know, the men being brought in with giant burns or their, you know, arms bleeding. And that was when Kaiser Steel was really one of the biggest steel plants in the United States. And I grew up sort of in the shadow of the smog of Kaiser Steel. But it was also, it is this current political climate, but it was also just this feeling that as my girls were grown women now, that I'm writing about things differently than some of the essays I had worked on for years when they were small. Raising small children, you think in a different way. And now looking at my daughters being women out in the world, some of the things that are happening to them, those were things that are that would have not happened to them 10 years ago. I don't know, Marie, it's a big combination. It's also, to me, having realized all of a sudden in my 50s that no one did ever care about the stories of the women and how they migrated. It's always, you know, the pioneers go west, and I would realize I'd watch a Ken Burns documentary, and I liked them very much, but women might be like 2% of the voices in a Ken Burns documentary. And I thought, wait, who was doing all the laundry? Who was taking care of all the babies? And then I just kept, I was rereading the Homeric myths and stories because my youngest daughter, Rosette, was a classics major at USC. And we went to Rome, and we were, you know, reading all the myths. And I thought, where are the women? Like, where are they on the boat? Mm-hmm. Who's, is it only a male cook every time? And then I realized that all the women in our family were the ones that had undertaken these Odyssean journeys in order to arrive in Southern California, which they considered the promised land.
I love the weave of the Odyssey throughout this. There's even, I mean, in the middle of the book somewhere, there's the possum that you compare to on her own Odysseus sort of journey. And it's a thread that pulls all the way through. That prologue about Homerica is just so beautiful. And it does feel like the right organizing principle upon which you would build this big structure around. And, you know, I was kind of wondering if that was there sort of from the beginning as you know, the kind of the through line for you.
Oh, that you're so funny to bring up Daisy May, my favorite possum. I cried when she finally died. I was really upset. My girls were like, they couldn't believe it. They're like, but she tortured you and she kept us awake forever. And I said, but she was a mom. And I cried. I was very sad when she died. That's that whole journey thing, I think, was always in my mind because, I don't know about you, but I love road trip novels. I love journey things where geography is part of the story. And I did not know the structure at all. I just knew it couldn't be chronological because my editor even said, well, what about a family tree, you know, for readers? And I tried to put together a family tree, and just on, like, one branch of the Sims side, like, somebody who was one of 12 children married someone who was one of 12 children, and then they had 12 children. I'm like, see, this is not going to work. But what I found was structure is always the most difficult. That's what we all talk about, isn't it? As writers and as readers who are also wanting to write, it's the structure that kills you. So you can't just have chronological order, especially with this many women and this many heroic journeys. So I kept thinking about all the different journeys Odysseus takes and all the stops, and what it meant for him to try to escape with his men. And then I realized that the women in this memoir have all the men trying to stop them. Like, men are the Circe who are like, no, just stay here. And men are the lotus eaters who are like, just stay here and get drunk, and, you know, the kids will take care of themselves. And instead, the women got up with their weapons, which was usually a gun or their brains, and they took their children and fled, and each time they fled further west. And so that structure was really helpful. Then I had to figure out where to put my story, mine and Duane's. We were the, you know, the beneficiaries of all the braveries of these women, but we never left. So that was a whole different thing, too. Like you said, then I realized it was people who leave and people who stay. One day I was giving a talk 6 years ago at Rancho Los Alamitos. You know where that is, right?
Yeah.
In Long Beach.
Long Beach, yeah.
And Don Waldie was there, one of my favorite writers who, you know, still lives in the house where he was born in Lakewood. And DJ and I are like, we're buddies in the homeland. So someone had asked me that question, and I said, there are people who leave and people who stay. That's the only two kinds of people in the world. And a woman came up to me afterward, and she said, no, there's a third kind. She said, people who come back. And I put a big L on my forehead with me. I'm like, oh, my gosh, you're right, the losers. She started laughing. She was from Huntington Beach, and she said, no, it's when you come back that you think about both places. That was a huge help to me.
Yeah.
I don't know her name, but she was the one that really got me to thinking about that.
Well, to your point about people who stay, your house in this is almost its own character, this house that you have been in forever. And I think the only picture of the house, correct me if I'm wrong, is your author photo. I suspect the little green shingles behind you is your house. But I kept flipping through the book. I kept looking through the book, looking for images of the house. But, you know, the house is painted so beautifully, you know, with your words. But, that house was just as vivid of a character to me as anyone else. It's, you know, it's such a beautiful thing to stay.
Well, that's really nice of you to say that, because my previous author photo was taken in front of my garage, which was painted white. And the guy that took my previous photo, he usually did car shows, and so he had mermaids that, like, could dance up and down on his forearms. So the girls found that immensely hilarious. This time I stood in front of my porch where I sit and, like, where everybody comes to visit. The house, the funny thing about, I just finished writing about three white houses, and they're all in the memoir. And the first white house belongs to Aunt Jenny. She is the daughter of Fine, sort of the origin woman for this book. Fine's mother was enslaved in Tennessee, and Fine is orphaned at five and keeps a bullet in her pocket when she's nine, hoping to kill someone, and eventually survives and with five children makes her way to Tulsa, where her daughter Jenny has shot someone between the eyes after being attacked. And Jenny made it to L.A., and she lived on 21st Street and Central in historic South Central Los Angeles. And I just looked up the census documents and voter registration, wanting to know exactly when Jenny bought the house and when she left it. And she was there for 40 years, and that was a white wood frame bungalow, you know, like all the houses you see in every sort of downtown area of every town in America. And Jenny took in six of her children, her half-sister's children. She took in boarders, probably hundreds of people went through that house. And then there's another house in Riverside, Daisy Carter's house. That's Duane's grandmother, and she, too, had five children, migrated from Sunflower County, Mississippi, and had a white house full of people. So mine was the third white house. And finally, we painted it green. But I can't tell you, there have been hundreds of kids that have, you know, slept there and lived there and left their jeans behind there. I have an inexhaustible supply of jeans that girls have left behind, 57 pairs by last count. So you're right, my house where I have lived for 31 years, it's a character to me, too.
Yeah.
And Daisy Mae the possum having her babies under the house.
Right. I love that.
Oh, my goodness, I couldn't stop her. She got in no matter what. I just got used to it.
I'm going to ask a question that I'm not smart enough to ask. It's a feeling that I have that you'll maybe be smarter to unpack than I am. But something about this book got me thinking about all the sub-languages that exist within the English language. And, I mean, I guess a lot of people call those dialects. But I wonder, in a country that's the size of like a dozen European countries that would speak, you know, two dozen languages, even within California, to consider all the dialects of English, and the way you use language, I just don't in my life use words like kin and pigs and hogs and possums. And you're right next door to, you know, the Valley Girl language of the 80s, or, you know, the Hollywood language or the Santa Monica language or the Silicon Valley language. And I just feel like the language itself can do so many things that, I mean, maybe this is a super obvious point, but But we so rarely touch all the edges of what our language can do. And this book just kind of opened my eyes up to the possibilities. And if you just pulled out a bunch of nouns from your book, they're just nouns that I don't normally use. And it's you have this really beautiful image of your husband going into the Narnia. You call it, you know, like when he'd go to work at night, it was like he was going into Narnia. And I just felt that way about this whole book, that I felt like it was this passage to another world that's right next door to my world, and I don't know it very well. And the language itself is what opened that whole world up to me and made me think about things differently. I don't even know what the question is.
I think that's a nice thing for you to have me think about today, because we just had Labor Day. You know, 150 people were gathered in my cousin Terry's driveway for Labor Day, and the driveway is the other central. There's the houses, but we live our lives in the driveway. And when I just have been on tour in New York and, you know, other places. I'm getting ready to go to Minneapolis and to Seattle, and people often ask me, like, what is this mythic status of the driveway? And when I was in Brooklyn, I looked at the stoop, you know, how, like, people, you live your life on the stoop. And I thought, but the driveway is where we live our lives because it's hot. And so we have a TV in the driveway, and we ate, you know, 150 people, we ate in the driveway on Sunday. And I do think you're totally right. It's from me being a listener. I always tell my students, you have to be a good listener. You have to have a good ear to be a writer. And you don't think that. You think you're going to need solitude, and you need that as well. But, like, you know, my cousin's telling stories, and my daughter was there. My daughter Delphine and her husband Kumi, and Kumi's from Ibadan, Nigeria. So we sat Kumi down at the domino table for the first time, and he was playing dominoes with my brother-in-law General the Third, and three other of our cousins. And so, you know, he slammed down the domino and he's like, fitting. And we were laughing. We were like, Kumi, you have to say it that way. You can't say the F. And Kumi's like, so I just leave consonants out. Is that it? It was the best moment ever. And, you know, the way our cousins are like, well, you know, we're going to have that party over there in Cuddy Land. And Cuddy Land means that when you call someone a cousin, you call him Cuddy. And then he lives in Cuddy Land, which is this neighborhood where a bunch of our cousins live. And that's on the other side of the river. I realized we had this secret language. But the joy of my life on Saturday and Sunday was that my middle daughter and her husband were there. And that's going to be who we pass the language down to. And it's also mixed with Nigerian words now. And my favorite word in the book might be baradari, which is a Pakistani Indian word, meaning your extended network of kin. It's not just your blood family, but when you grow up like this, you have your extended family. You have someone you call your cousin or your brother who isn't blood related, but you've known him since you were five, and he's the guy you would call. You know, when the earthquake happened, you're going to call that cousin, and he will come and get you in his giant truck. So I like that you brought that up, because all the languages, like my girls have their own secret language as well. As three daughters growing up, you know, we knew exactly what these things were. But here's a real Southern California one. Do you know what a pedidol is?
I do not. What is
a pedidol? Is when you're all, there's like eight of you in a car, and a car's coming towards you and only has one headlight. You know, one headlight's out,
uh-huh.
And so you say pedidol and you get to punch everyone else in the car. I would have to say my daughters really embrace the pediddle, which that was from growing up in 70s California and just being bored, and we always had to find a way to make time pass. And so my brothers and I would always punch each other. So all those little words, you're right, get put together. Maybe that's a writer's favorite thing, but I love the exuberance of our language. My next-door neighbor, Mario, was making chorizo the other night, and he was like, no, this is Salvadoran chorizo. You have to try it. And my daughter and I tried it, and we were like, this is good. And he just started laughing. And he's like, nobody knows how many kinds of chorizo there are. And so, I feel lucky that I get to know all that stuff.
Right, right. So fun. And there's a lot of scary stuff you had to write in here. I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but there are, you know, babies lost and really significant scary childhood accident and divorce, you know, just... And a lot of discovering of scary stuff about your ancestors and what they went through, generational trauma and inherited trauma. And I was wondering if kind of what was the hardest to write? Was it the hardest to write to trudge up your own memories of things that had happened to you, or was it difficult to discover what had happened to these other women before you and write about what they had gone through and kind of how you allowed yourself to access all the scary stuff and go deep enough into it to bring it this much to life?
You know, I think it was just as hard to hear and truly understand and write about some of the things that had happened to our female ancestors, especially, that it was just as hard to do that as it was to write about myself. I mean, I did write about myself because part of, again, what we were saying in the beginning of this conversation, it's not just a Me Too movement. It's more like women have always told these stories to each other, but only to each other. And, you know, all the things that happened to us when we were kids, like you got into a car because you needed a ride and you were 2 miles away. And that whole thing that is very also SoCal, gas, grass, or ass, nobody rides for free. That sounds awful, but we got into cars and, you know, bad things happened to us because we needed a ride. And when we tried to tell someone about those bad things, people would say, well, why didn't you walk home? Well, if we walked, we were told that it would be worse. So some of that was really hard for me to write about, but equally hard was for me to think about Aunt Jenny, you know, being attacked and why she always carried a gun and how many times she must have been attacked to have always that gun. She had, they said she always had a pistol in her bosom and she would be dancing with it and it would fall to the floor and she'd bend over, pick it up, and keep right on dancing. Those were some of the iconic stories that I heard way back when I was 14 or 15. You know, Marie, I think one of the hardest was hearing about how many of my friends and relatives that, you know, bad things happened to us when we were so young, and a couple of the things that had happened to girls when they were only, you know, 10 or 15, and I knew those girls for the rest of my life. I still know them. Those things never change in their heads, that those scars remain scars. Scar tissue doesn't go away. So the fact that we speak up about it now, just, you know, all of the things going on in the news right now, from Jeffrey Epstein to Bill Cosby to everything else, hearing all of those women tell their stories so bravely and hearing those stories often dismissed, that was the painful part. The Brett Kavanaugh hearings were a huge deal when I was finishing this book, and that, I think, more than anything else, because those two people, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and Judge Kavanaugh, were so close to my age, made me remember all of those parties where all of those bad things happened to me and my friends, or all the ways that girls would tell each other the story and not even bother telling anyone else. That was a big deal to me when I was finishing this memoir. And as I've gone around to talk to pretty big audiences, I'm careful to say that I'm not diminishing the men in the audience in any way, but I am saying that often we are only going to tell these stories to each other because that's what we want. We wanted someone to listen, and if that person was our friend or our teacher or our cousin, we're often finished then, aren't we? Right. Like, we told the story and someone believed us, and then we don't go tell a man.
Right.
I don't know. I think that's the hard part, but that's the part I wanted to write about.
God, that's such a great book. And it's got so much more in it. It's such a wonderful love story to literature and books and all the stuff you grew up on. My only consolation in having to end our conversation is that you're coming to the speaker series on October 22nd at Lido Books. And so we get a chance to talk some more and I get to hear more of these stories. And so if you're out there listening and you want to hear more from Susan, she'll be at Lido Books October 22nd. You can go on Barbara's website, penonfire.com, and read more about that. Susan, where can we find more about you online?
I am terrible with my website. I have been yelled at many times by my children in the last month. I am trying to be good on Instagram, but mostly I like posting pictures of, like, Kumi learning to play dominoes. But I have Instagram now. But my website is lovely, and actually it is one of my favorite things to look at. I just need to update the things about the book and about going out to read. But I'm really excited to come talk to you and Barbara at Lido Books, because I also would love to talk about how books save our lives. A lot of us, it's books that saved our lives. True.
True.
And that'll be a fun thing to be able to bring up. Sula is a huge part, Toni Morrison's novel Sula, and she passed away the day this book came out, and that just really made the whole week of me talking about the book and realizing that I had raised my three daughters with books and museums. That's how we were rescued. I'm looking forward to talking to you about that.
I loved, so much more to talk about. Susan Strait, what a joy. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
That was Susan Strait. The book, In the Country of Women, is out and available now. And as I said, she'll be at Lido October 22nd. That's all the time we have for this week. Barbara will be on next week with Georgiana Marie and Helen Phillips. In the meantime, stay tuned for Rock Coaster. Some great tunes coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great, great day.